Our final case for argument today is United States against Irby. Ms. Stroud, the switch is on the right-hand side.
It's not too bad for my height, so okay. I'll just leave it the way it is. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. The government in this case admits that it erred, and we believe that a new trial should be ordered in this case. The question is whether or not the error, being the admission of this hearsay, caused a miscarriage of justice or severely...
I don't understand the government's concession, so I would like to hear an argument about why you think this is plain error. I've never understood how, even in principle, admission of hearsay can be plain error, because it's often in the defendant's interest to have hearsay rather than live testimony. Right? If you make the hearsay objection and the judge sustains it, it may be the next thing that happens is you're now facing a live witness and you're worse off. I looked through our cases. I couldn't find any case in the history of the Seventh Circuit holding that admitting hearsay was plain error when the consequence of the objection would have been live testimony and the defendant would have been worse off.
Well, the defendant might not have been any worse off if the
government...
Might
not have been. The prosecutor might not have brought the informant in, but then again, he might.
The informant in this case, not the informant, but the police officer in this case testified that this confidential informant, who was not named, was...
Let's just go back to the legal question. Do you know of any case holding that it is plain error not to exclude hearsay when there has been no hearsay objection?
I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court in Moore addressed that question, and it was cited in my brief. We talked about in great detail in my initial brief about the effect of U.S. versus Williams was a Seventh Circuit case, 133 Federal 3rd, 1048, admitting prejudicial testimony such as the hearsay and not giving the jury a limiting instruction was plain error.
But was there an objection in Moore? I mean, in your brief, you say that the court holds that the informants' out-of-court declarations are hearsay, they're inadmissible, mm-hmm. no exception.
Right. But
indeed, Moore has nothing to do with plain error. It's
the question is an objection.
It's irrelevant.
In the Williams case...
I mean, we would all agree that if there had been an objection, then, of course, you would force a hearsay rule.
When you have out-of-court testimony that goes to the gist of a criminal offense, the Supreme Court has held that that is a violation of one's constitutional rights to confront a witness. And as such, if that is of such a nature that it is highly prejudicial, would cause a serious miscarriage of justice, or bring disrepute to the
So you say this is a Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause problem, not just a hearsay?
Definitely, yes.
Problem.
It begins with a constitutional right being involved, which is the, right to confront or not confront witnesses.
It's the same point.
Right.
Whether you call it hearsay or lack of confrontation, that is, it's often in the defendant's interest to have a weak version of the evidence presented rather than a strong version of the evidence. And if we say when hearsay is presented, the district judge must exclude it whether or not the defendant objects, and that's the argument you're making. When hearsay is presented, district judge can't wait for an objection. The district judge must say, that's hearsay, it's excluded. Defendants will often be worse off. And the question is that a sensible use of the plain error doctrine?
But respectfully, the testimony in this case was not at all of any nature that would have helped the defendant. The testimony in this case was that he was labeled a drug trafficker.
You're missing my point, counsel, that if hearsay is excluded, often the next thing that happens is to bring in the live testimony.
Fine.
That's what makes the defendant worse off.
And if that had happened, then the defendant would have had to have faced that, but we don't even know the name of this person. It was never disclosed.
I understand that, but I can just imagine the case where the defendant's lawyer objected. The hearsay is excluded. The prosecutor brings in the informant.
Right.
And the next thing we hear is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for making that stupid hearsay objection.
Judge, day in and day out in the trial courts, they make hearsay objections, and I have not seen an ineffective assistance of counsel claim when they have made an objection of hearsay. That doesn't happen on any kind of reasonable basis.
Put it more in a strategic situation where maybe they purposely don't object just to see how it works out, and then if it doesn't work out in their favor, then they claim this failure to object. It would seem that someone could purposely not object just to see if that flows by. Now, it may be a little hypothetical, but I think this, I'm just following up on what Judge Easterbrook said.
Right. I don't think that was this case at all. The defense attorney was not even aware that the informant had made any controlled buys in the case. The first time he heard of that was when the police officer was on the witness stand.
No, we had a lot of these cases. Was it in your brief where you said that issue was going to be reserved for habeas?
There are other issues besides failing to object to this that would serve as a basis for ineffective assistance of counsel and under 2255, and we've reserved those other issues, among them being that the defense attorney brought in some mail that the defendant had received at his father's house, and one of those that he brought in, besides medical bills, was a probation report. And
you did say something about that in your brief.
There are other issues that are beyond failing to object to this hearsay that would go to ineffective assistance. So, any other questions? I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hartzler.
Very good point, Your Honor. Very good point that the hearsay would have been a non-hearsay testimony of the informant, very likely, had the objection been asserted by defense counsel.
Mr. Hartzler, that said, and I want to put that to one side, I was very disturbed by the methodology that your brief took because it treated the trial as though it was some kind of Franks hearing that you could say, well, you know, what would have been there. But, of course, we know, I mean, trials are in front of juries. We don't know how the jury would have weighed any of that evidence. So I don't think that methodology works well in the trial situation.
I accept that. Obviously, you understood what we were trying to do.
Right, but I just don't think it's a permissible way of approaching a jury trial, since juries are entitled to believe and disbelieve what they want, and they have a whole mixture of evidence in front of them, et cetera, all of the things we know about juries. And if you think of a range of cases, ranging from things like Brecht against Abrahamson to Strickland to others, I mean, if what came in that shouldn't have been in undermines your confidence in the outcome, that really ought to be enough. I don't know what the jury would have thought if this fronting the idea that this guy was a drug trafficker and all this testimony from the police officer hadn't come in.
Nor do I, but I was hoping that by presenting the narrative of the offense without the hearsay evidence, we could distinguish and isolate what came in as hearsay. Whereas the presentation is as a narrative, it wouldn't have identified any of the information in the narrative.
But I understood you also to be saying that, in a sense, that there was so much other evidence in this case inculpating Mr. Irby that whatever hearsay problems there may have been were harmless. Maybe I was putting words in your mouth.
No, that's right. That's right.
And I'm not sure that that's right. I think that this was not such an open and shut case.
I didn't hear your last.
This did not strike me. Again, putting to one side the point Judge Easterbrook makes, this did not strike me as such an open and shut case that I would be comfortable saying that.
Judge Wood, I understand that. I accept that. I'm trying to understand your criticism of the methodology so that I don't repeat the error.
Oh, my concern is I think if evidence has been erroneously admitted in a jury trial, you can't say what would the jury have thought if it had never heard that evidence. You have to say, well, even having heard it, there was so much more evidence they would have come out the same way or other things. I don't think just you're not like a magistrate judge reviewing a search warrant affidavit who can disregard inappropriate things. I think the jury dynamic is different.
Do you mind my pursuing the methodology criticism?
That would be fine.
What I try to do is present a narrative of the offense without the hearsay and then to isolate the hearsay so it was obvious to the court and others who read the brief what the hearsay testimony was, not include that as part of the narrative. The narrative of the offense does not identify who the speakers are, what the testimony is. And I thought that I understand that it's presented as though it's a Franks hearing matter, and it's not, conceitedly. So we could have presented the narrative to include the hearsay testimony. Yes, we could have done that. I thought that it would be then confusing to go back and try to figure out what of this was hearsay and what was not. And ultimately our point is that the non-hearsay testimony does overpower any of the hearsay. It's not that the jurors didn't hear the hearsay, nor can we necessarily conclude what the jurors decided the case based on. But I would urge you to, if you look at the videotape and consider the evidence outside of the hearsay testimony, it's very strong. I mean, the videotape really shows what was going on that day, and you've got to appreciate it. It's a fairly small house with the bedroom has the drugs strewn out on the bedspread, on the bed. The three or four scales are right there. Most importantly, the video monitors you'll see are live. The camera, he has three cameras outside of the house with the three video monitors right in the bedroom. Obviously, when that man that came up to buy the marijuana showed up outside, he saw him in the camera. You can see from the bedspread that he was packaging and cleaning the marijuana right there with the crack cocaine, packaged up the $10 bag of marijuana and walked outside from that very bedroom. So it's very, very clear, I think, and it's hard, in my opinion, to look at the video and not see that as pretty much trumping every other piece of evidence in this case. I concede we can't go back and read what the jurors would have concluded. I understand your point on that.
I think as you're saying it now, I mean, if it's just an ordinary harmless error argument, people make those arguments all the time. That's fine. As long as you're not trying to say, henceforth, when we evaluate trials with evidentiary errors, we should just delete the evidence that the jury shouldn't have heard and then ask whether the rest of it was enough to support the verdict. That's the part I don't want you to do.
Oh, on a sufficiency? No, yeah. No. I understand. Okay, yeah. Sorry. Then I think we were just miscommunicating.
Okay.
Yes. But it is a plain error standard, of course, in which this court has indicated you should retry or relive the whole trial imaginatively, and I would urge you to watch the videotape, and I think you will conclude that that was a very, very powerful piece of evidence under the circumstance.
The Supreme Court has taken to posting videos on its website. Should we start posting these? Is this available in a digital form for distribution to the legal consuming public?
I don't think there'd be any harm in this particular case.
I'm not sure this videotape is quite like a chase, however.
No, probably not.
I don't think you'll find this on YouTube. but I do. I am underscoring the fact that it's very powerful evidence. If there are no further questions, thank you again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Straub?
Yes, just briefly.
I think the court correctly observed that the question is not whether or not there was other evidence that might have led to a conviction. I disagree with the government about the strength of their case. I don't think they were confident in it, or they would not have stooped to some of the things that they did in this trial. The government's attorney that prosecuted the case was very deliberate in his questioning of the police officer to elicit all this hearsay. And he went even further and asked the police officer whether the informant looked at mug shots. He didn't use the term mug shots. He said, had the police officer testify that he went back to the station, went to their database, and pulled out a handful of photographs of individuals and showed those to the informant who positively identified the defendant. So the government's conduct in this case was very deliberate. This was not an instance where the police officer just slipped when he said something that was wrong. It was very thought out, and the officer was merely responding to a number and series of questions. The government, in their opening statement, said that the police officer had received evidence that the defendant was a drug trafficker. So he's telling the jury right from the beginning that the informant is producing evidence. The informant, of course, is confidential and unknown even to us as we stand here today. So in looking at the case and the standard, which is not whether or not there might have been other evidence that would have sustained a conviction, it's whether or not the admission of the hearsay would cause a miscarriage of justice or seriously affect the fairness of the proceedings and integrity of the proceedings. And I don't believe, based on all of the things that occurred in that regard, that this defendant received a fair trial. He did not. And I would ask the court to enter a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Straub, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.